podcast for all but geared toward adult first-time readers of Harry Potter, who need a space to enjoy each book and have adult conversations about it. My name is Sarah, and I'm honored that you've allowed me on this journey with you. Crack open a butterbeer, grab a seat, and let's discuss. Today, we're talking about the Weasleys and the Ministry. Welcome, everybody, to episode 30 of First Years. Today, we're going over chapters 5 through 7 of Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire. These chapters lead us right up until the start of the Quidditch World Cup, and we have some interesting things to discuss. But first, house points. So Hufflepuff has maintained their lead, and they now have 770 points. Gryffindor lost second place, they're now in third. Slytherin pulled ahead by 60 points for a total of 360. Gryffindor has 300 and Ravenclaw has 130. So as always, you can earn house points by rating and reviewing this podcast wherever you listen to it. And if you mention your name and your Hogwarts house, you'll earn double house points. That is how Slytherin managed to get into the lead this time. Thanks to Emily Cavender rating and reviewing. Thank you very much. Also participating in our Mindful Magic Mondays, as well as our trivia, which we've been having every Wednesday, and people seem to really enjoy that. So make sure you're following First Years Podcast, which is at First Years Pod on Instagram, to have opportunities to win house points. So we pick up right where we left off. Dudley is still under the effects of the candy that Fred and George have given him, and Harry flees to the Weasleys. And we find out that they invented the candy as part of Weasley's Wizard Wheezes, which is their business endeavor. But before we get into that, and we will get into that because there's a lot to talk about, we meet the eldest Weasley siblings, Bill and Charlie. Charlie we met briefly by letter in book one because he's the one who works with dragons and he took Norbert off of our hands when Hagrid couldn't take care of him anymore. So Charlie is exactly what you would expect someone who works with dragons to look like, more built up than Ron or Percy with a burn on his arm. But Bill comes as a real surprise to Harry because he's cool. He has long hair, he's wearing a fang earring, he's dressed like he should be at a rock concert, and he works as a curse breaker for Gringotts, which has to be a really cool job. Like, I feel like out of all the jobs that the Weasley boys have, these two have to be the coolest. One of my questions, though, because I can't help myself, is that we get a detail about Bill wearing dragon hide boots. And this is one of my questions that I hope we can talk about in the future because it seems like a lot of potions ingredients are from animals, and I wonder about the ethics and the sustainability of that. And I wonder about this too, because I know that we need dragon hide gloves for Hogwarts, and it makes sense. They're probably much more durable and withstand heat better than regular leather. But Charlie works on a dragon reserve. Does this bother him? I don't know, it just seems a little odd with like meeting Charlie and then getting a detail that Bill is wearing dragon hide boots. Like the juxtaposition of that just feels a little odd to me. But that's just something to think about. Anyway, if we continue on with the Weasley children, we learn that Percy does work for the Ministry now and works under Mr. Crouch, who we meet later in Chapter 7. And currently, Percy is working on a very important report on standardizing cauldron thickness. Now, I know that Harry and Ron and everyone else want to make fun of Percy for this, and I get it. He's cooped up working and not being any fun. But, and I don't know if this is a hot take or not. I think that actually is a very important thing to be working on, because certain regulations are actually really important. And he has a point that they'd want to make sure that the cauldrons follow the same standard rules for being made, so that you don't have a market of flimsy cauldrons. Like, I'm not defending Percy here, but I'm just saying that I get it. And speaking of the ministry, I want to talk about Molly and Arthur Weasley in these chapters and dive into a little bit of their parenting, which we've talked about before in regards to Harry, but I think we see some really interesting things in regards to their own children in these chapters. So let's chat about Molly first. We see her opinions on some of her children in these chapters, and I think it gets us into a really interesting discussion of what we want versus what our parents want for us, and it can cause some tension. With Fred and George, she's disappointed that they didn't get as many OWLs as she had hoped. These are fifth year exams. Getting three really means that they only had like a high enough grade on three of them. We'll learn more about those later on. And she doesn't support their dream of opening a joke shop because she'd rather them work at the ministry. What's unsaid here is that she thinks that working at the ministry is more worthwhile than opening a joke shop, because it's more serious or more prestigious than working at a joke shop. But they've actually been inventing things, even if they are a little bit dangerous. And they have the drive to make order forms and figure out a way to sell these things at Hogwarts. That doesn't seem like no ambition, like Mrs. Weasley puts it. She says, quote, "I don't know what's going to happen to them. I really don't. No ambition unless you count making as much trouble as they possibly can." She also says, "It's not as though they haven't got brains, but they're wasting them, and unless they pull themselves together soon, they'll be in real trouble." So she agrees that her sons are smart, but thinks they aren't showing any ambition because they aren't doing what she wants them to do. And she's worried that they'll end up in the improper use of magic office. So we can look at this in two ways. One, she's being a bad mother. Or two, she's trying to be a good mother out of concern for her sons, but she isn't going about it in the right way. I can understand that she's worried. But as far as we know, the boys aren't doing anything illegal. They're experimenting and creating their own products. And her attitude about it is straining the relationship between her and her sons. They leave for the Quidditch Cup angry at her for confiscating their products, and she's mad at them too. She says that it was a fine way to spend 6 months. And what she really means here is that it was a complete waste of time and they should have been doing something more productive. We see another moment like this with Bill, where she wants to cut his hair and calls his earring a horrible great fang. And it seems like Gringotts are more like our modern day offices, where like you don't have to dress up in a suit and tie all the time, and you can have tattoos and longer hair, and yes, a fang earring, they don't care as long as you do your work well. Bill, she can't really do anything about because he's an adult who lives on his own at this point. Fred and George, she has more say over, and it's her house, I get it, but I also feel like this could do some serious damage. You're invalidating their interests and their dreams and making them feel like they aren't living up to your expectations and so aren't as quote-unquote good as your other children because they want different things. It's just interesting to see because I think so far in the series that we'd say that Mrs. Weasley's a really good mother and is kind of a stand-in for Harry's mother in a lot of ways. So it's interesting to see her lose her mind a little bit over what her kids like to do and what she expects of them or hopes for them. Now on to Arthur, who comes back after sorting out Dudley's tongue and is mad at Fred and George again, but sort of gets caught in the middle because he poses this empty threat to Fred and George about telling their mother. And then they get caught by Molly, so he's forced to tell her what happened when he actually wasn't really planning on telling her. But something interesting that he says here is, it isn't funny. That sort of behavior seriously undermines wizard-muggle relations. I spend half my life campaigning against the mistreatment of muggles and my own sons. And Fred and George respond that they didn't give it to Dudley because he's a muggle, but because he's a jerk. And I understand that this is more of like a morals thing rather than a I want you to do something different thing. But it got me wondering about muggle-wizard relations. Because most of what we've seen in these chapters is wizards hiding from muggles or messing with their minds, which doesn't seem like something you would want to do if you're promoting positive relationships between muggles and wizards. For example, when they reach the campsite for the Quidditch World Cup, they have to check in with a worker of the campground who is a muggle, whose memory is being modified up to 10 times a day. That seems like a huge violation of an individual's privacy and rights. Does 10 obliviate spells, what does that do for a person in the long run? Like, what does it affect? They're completely taking advantage of this person. Same thing with the terminology of anti-muggle precautions and anti-muggle security. Calling it that subconsciously causes people to treat muggles differently, I would bet, because that kind of wording absolutely matters. And it just continues to promote the image that muggles do not belong in wizard spaces. But not all wizards are purebloods. Some are muggleborns, and some are halfbloods. So would Hermione's parents not be allowed on the campground? Seamus's dad is not mentioned in this chapter. I went back and checked. We meet his mother, and Dean Thomas is with him. So is her husband not allowed to come? Are Dean's parents not allowed to come either? What does that do to muggles and relationships with wizards? Is there discrimination or othering within social circles with people who are dating muggles? It just seems really odd that Mr. Weasley talks about setting an example and fighting for proper treatment of muggles, and then we see anti-muggle magic and no muggles around in these spaces at all. Like, I'd probably want to see some Quidditch if I was a muggle mother of a witch or wizard. That doesn't seem fair. Like, if I walked into the campground, or would I not even be able to be at the campground because of the anti-muggle precautions, even if I knew all about the wizarding world? So I'm really very curious as to what that's like for those parents, especially those who are in relationships with wizards. And going along with this, Mr. Weasley says that they're not allowed to use magic when they're all together in these kinds of numbers while on muggle land. So, is there wizarding land? I would assume Hogwarts is on wizarding land, right? That seems to make the most sense to me. But then why don't wizards have specific wizard land to hold the World Cup? Or just like events like this in general. Why do they have to take over muggle land? While we're here at the campsite, we get introductions to the various departments of the ministry as Arthur Weasley points them out to Harry and Hermione. And it's here that we meet Ludo Bagman and Barty Crouch. And we learn that Percy talks a big game about his work, but Mr. Crouch barely knows who he is because he calls him Weatherby instead of Weasley. And I feel bad, but I also find this moment very funny because as readers, we're on Harry's side, right? So we also find Percy annoying and pompous, and we want someone like that to get knocked down a peg. One of my questions, though, about Crouch is that he speaks like 200 languages. Where did he learn them? We have not had any mention of Hogwarts teaching any languages, not even other human languages, let alone Mirmish and others. So where did he learn it? Who did he learn it from? Do we think he learned it, like, at another school, or did he study them himself? It takes a while to study enough to be at a conversational level of a language, especially if you aren't fully immersed in the language. So that's just something to ponder. But while we're here, let's rewind just a bit and talk about how we got to the campsite. Our crew uses a portkey, which is an inanimate object that you can charm to transport you to a different place at a specific time. So we learn that there are different ways to travel in the wizarding world. The form that we've seen most has been on brooms or on a train, which is how we get to Hogwarts. However, they need to stagger different kinds of travel so as not to raise suspicion to the Muggles. So portkeys are used and other wizards apparate. We also learn that flying carpets are a thing, but they were banned years ago, even though someone wants to bring them back into style for families. So when we get to our portkey, we meet the Diggorys. Cedric is a Hufflepuff who we met last book, who tried to stop the match after he caught the snitch when Harry fell from his broom, but they wouldn't let him. And we have a really awkward moment with his father, who's trying to prove that Cedric is better than Harry, which all of our main characters and Cedric find awkward and uncomfortable and unnecessary. When we're learning about apparition, we learn that it's dangerous because you could splinch yourself. This means leaving part of yourself behind and needing the accidental magic reversal squad to make it right. Here's my question. How do people not die from bleeding out? Like, if you leave your leg behind, is it fully intact and your own body just doesn't have a leg anymore, but it's not an open wound? And also, how do you even get in touch with the squad when that happens? Do you need an owl, or is there a specific spell that you need to cast? What if you leave your wand arm behind? Is it still capable of casting whatever spell you need, if it is in fact a spell that you need to summon the magic reversal squad? Plus, like, that has to be a very traumatic experience. Is there support from the ministry after that? I'm very curious as to what you guys think. One more mode of transport that we see here is walking, and I've been holding on to this detail specifically for this episode, and I'm so glad we've arrived. So, walking is another form of transport that we see here, and they walk a quarter of a mile to the campsite. And Rowling writes that it takes 20 minutes. 20 minutes for a quarter of a mile. And it's not even like they're stopping and looking at stuff, because I double-checked this. It literally says that due to the mist, they can't really see anything until 20 minutes later. This is a group of able-bodied wizards. There is no reason for it to take them 20 minutes to walk a quarter of a mile. I don't know if this is an editing thing or an American English, British English thing, but to put it in perspective, it takes me around 20 minutes to walk a full mile. That means a quarter of a mile should only take about 5 minutes. I know I can run it in 3. So why do we think it takes them that long? I've been wanting to test this out since I reread this book, so please keep an eye out for an Instagram Live where we're gonna see how slow I have to walk in order to walk a quarter of a mile in 20 minutes. I'm telling you, this detail has been bothering me since I reread Goblet of Fire. Shoot me your best theories on that. But anyway, there are 3 more things I want to touch on briefly here. The first being, are Fred and George really old enough to gamble? They're 15. That doesn't seem right to me. The second being that Bertha Jorkins is mentioned in these chapters. She's missing. Percy talks about it with his dad when he's comparing Crouch and Bagman. That Bertha's missing and Crouch is concerned about it, while Bagman doesn't seem to care. He's insisting that she's probably just lost somewhere in the world and she'll find her way back. Doesn't really seem like someone you'd want to work under if just stopping showing up for work isn't something that they care enough about to be concerned. So what do you think that means? But I also want you to flip back to chapter one. This is where we've heard of Bertha Jorkins before. Because we know she isn't missing. She's dead. Voldemort and Wormtail had her. Wormtail took her to Voldemort, thinking she'd be useful, and they got information out of her, and they killed her. So what do we think that has anything to do with? The third thing here is that we learn about something secret that's going to be going on at Hogwarts this year. We have no idea what it is, but Percy brings it up, hoping someone will ask him about it. And the people we've heard talk about it seem excited. So what do we think it is? And one more question that I want to ask, specifically about Chapter 7, is why is this chapter called Bagman and Crouch? Why are they so important that they get their own chapter name? Let us know at firstyearspodcast@gmail.com. You can also reach out to us on Twitter or Instagram @firstyearspod. I so want to hear all of your thoughts, and I'm so excited to hear them as we dive into these next few chapters. Thank you guys for joining me today, and I will see you guys next time. Sources can be found in our show notes or on our website at authorsarahjonesdittmeyer.info/firstyearspodcast. That's Sarah with an H, and Dittmeyer is spelled Dittmeier. Please remember that staying a Harry Potter fan is the biggest form of revolt that you can have, and we are committed to continuing